Hello and welcome to the AusMed Handover podcast. My name is Darren Wake and today I'm going to talk not just about the guinea pig club, but how you can form one of your own.
German aircraft carried out a number of attacks on Great Britain last night. The raids, which lasted for several hours, were scattered over many parts of the country, and enemy aircraft have been reported over towns on the south coast, the west of England, the North Midlands and the North West, as well as over the London area.
Explosion, which knocked the control stick from my hand, and the whole machine quivered like a stricken animal. In a second, the cockpit was a mass of flame. I reached up to open the hood. It wouldn't move. I tore off my straps and managed to force it back. But this took time, and when I dropped back into the seat and reached for the stick in an effort to turn the plane onto its back, the heat was so intense that I could feel myself going. I remember thinking, so this is it, and putting both my hands up to my eyes. Then I passed out. I regained consciousness free of the machine and falling rapidly. I pulled the ripcord of my parachute and checked my descent with a jerk. Looking down, I saw that my left trouser leg was burnt off, that I was going to fall into the sea, and that the English coast was deplorably far away. About 20 feet above the water, I attempted to undo my parachute, failed, and flopped into the sea with it billowing around me. The water was not unwarm, and I was pleasantly surprised to find that my life jacket kept me afloat. I looked at my watch. It was not there. Then for the first time I noticed how burnt my hands were. Down to the wrist the skin was dead white and hung in shreds. I felt faintly sick from the smell of burnt flesh. By closing one eye I could see my lips jutting out like Michelin tires, while the side of my parachute harness was particularly painful. So that I guess my right hip was burned.
Thanks to the BBC Archives for use of their interview with World War II Royal Air Force Flight Officer Richard Hillary. Hillary was one of Churchill's few that defended Britain against the Luftwaffe during the Battle of Britain. During this intense aerial battle, the average life expectancy of an RAF fighter pilot was just a scant 28 days. Their average age was just 22, and during the battle, which only lasted 114 days, a tragic 544 of these young men were killed. But that's only part of the tragedy. Over 1,547 RAF aircraft were shot down during the battle, and aside from those 544 pilots who were killed, a massive number of those who survived being shot down suffered the most horrific burns. So, in response to the rapidly growing number of pilots with such terrible injuries, and the recognition that they needed a special type of care, the RAF established a specialist burns unit at the Queen Victoria Hospital in East Grinstead in Sussex and recruited a specialist reconstructive surgeon by the name of Archibald McIndoe. McIndoe was able to set up a basic burns theatre with what gear he could cobble together under very difficult circumstances. But when the time came to recruit staff, he actively sought out nurses that understood that the process of healing was not simply limited to repairing damaged skin, muscle and bone, but rather encompassed a whole litany of interrelated concepts, including exercise, diet, motivation, lifestyle, attitude, and the patient's relationship with those around them. He recruited nurses who understood not just what a holistic approach to care actually meant, but practiced it every day. This team knew that their patients were so horrifically disfigured that they were likely to be inpatients for several months, if not years, and immediately decided that the ward would need to be something unique and set it up in such a way that the whole environment and everyone involved contributed to healing the bodies and minds of these severely disfigured young men. So whilst McIndoe devoted much of his time to developing radical new surgical techniques in the treatment of burns and reconstructive plastic surgery, the nurses set about delivering care and building a burns unit that was more like a home than a hospital ward. Patients were free to go on day leave whenever they wanted and were encouraged to get out into the local village as often as they could. They could bring visitors back to the ward whenever they wanted, and the ward itself had a lively social calendar, including a keg of beer that was replenished daily and nightly sing-alongs with McIndoe bashing away at the piano. And doctors, nurses, ancillary staff and former patients all began making time on the ward part of their life outside of work hours. People became friends, and given that the average age of both pilots and the nurses that were caring for them was only in their early 20s, friends became lovers, and by the end of the war, over 20 of the nursing staff had married men who were at one time patients on the ward. The patients of the ward formed what they called the Guinea Pig Club. Guinea pigs because of the experimental techniques tried on them by McIndoe, especially in the pioneering development of pedicle grafts for reconstructing facial features, and they were a notoriously wild bunch. The combination of McIndoe's radical techniques, the social atmosphere of the ward, and the blurring of the boundaries between patient and staff paid off in spades. The survival rates, surgical outcomes, and the social reintegration success stories were like nothing seen before or since. And that gives rise to the question, could this happen again? So imagine waking up every morning and feeling great about going to work, disregarding the lack of resources and heaviness of the workload, and thoroughly enjoying mucking in together with your colleagues at every level, feeling that the people you cared for were more like your friends than your patients, that they were motivated and thankful for your help. Sensing that everything you did and everyone else did was moving towards a positive outcome, sharing the daily workload equally, being told that your contribution was appreciated and that you were a valued member of a team, and at the end of the day, even preferring to stick around to help out, have a beer and have a laugh with your teammates and the patients, and just generally feeling great about being a nurse. Sorry, was I just dreaming? Yeah. For most nurses, in a time where care seems to be driven by budgetary and not clinical goals, this really is a dream. So what was it about the Guinea Pig Club that was so different? And can their magic formula be used by you to form a club of your own today?
How to form your own Guinea Pig Club.
Before we begin, we have to dispense with the idea that somehow the availability of human and material resources are a major factor in determining staff morale and positive clinical outcomes in any healthcare environment. They're not. And if anything, the Guinea Pig Club is a sterling example of this. In Britain during World War II, human and material resources were stretched to the absolute limit. And yet the Burns Ward was consistently producing excellent outcomes and had an outstanding level of staff morale. It's not an issue of resources, but rather how efficiently those resources are used, and efficiency is inextricably linked to motivation. So we should dispense with the idea that in some way great outcomes are only viable when human and material resources are in plentiful supply. I'm not saying that good outcomes don't come from this state of affairs, but what I am definitely saying is that optimal human and material resources are desirable, but they are not necessary to get the very best out of a given situation. We have to focus on the people and consider why they are the prime determinants.
Whatever.
I think the best way to understand where I'm going with this is to examine what the primary reason is that most teams don't work. And we need to travel back in time to 1913 to see why.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the magic of time travel.
Max Ringelmann was an engineer who was interested in researching the efficiency of machines. And in 1913, he conducted an experiment that revealed something incredible. Ringelmann tied a load meter to a tree, a rope to the load meter, and measured the force that could be exerted by one man pulling against the load meter. One man could exert a pulling force of around 100 pounds at his best, so he assumed that two men of similar size and similar strength would be able to exert a force of about 200 pounds. But to his surprise, he found that the combined effort of two men pulling at what they sincerely believed was their maximum effort only resulted in a pull force that was 186 pounds, or 93% of their potential load. So when three men of similar size were pulling together, the total was only 255 pounds, not 300 pounds, and so on, until eight similar-sized men pulling together at what they described as their best effort could only attain 49% of their potential pulling power, or a measly 392 pounds. So why was this? Of course, this result was perplexing, but repeated contemporary experiments confirm the phenomena in countless different environments. A group of individuals working as a team are usually less efficient than an individual working alone, and this phenomena is now described as social loafing. The nuts and bolts of social loafing explain the dynamics of why teams rarely work across a whole spectrum of situations, including nursing, and it's a real problem. It's more common on wards, especially where team nursing is practiced, and less common on intensive care units or in theatres, where individual performance is closely scrutinised. In fact, it can be found anywhere that a team of people deliver a service. It happens because in a team, individual performance is difficult to distinguish from the group's collective effort. And for many of us, that's a bonus. Slacking off is actually rational energy-conserving behaviour. Why invest all of your effort into some activity when half will do? Especially when your slacking off is masked by the efforts of the other members of the team. Of course, no one's performance drops to absolute zero. The manifestations of that are patently obvious in the nursing environment. Patients start to die. And no member of a team wants their reduced output to attract attention. That would simply be embarrassing. So, social loafing is generally a subtle game of gradual effort reduction to a point that is just enough to get by, but usually not much more. And everyone practices it, especially in any situation where members of the team have no personal investment in outcomes and no one audits their performance. I mean, if you don't get some kind of positive feedback for your efforts, or no matter how hard you work, you still get paid exactly the same as someone who sits at a desk all day long, texting on a phone or watching movies on their computer, your unconscious brain is going to simply make you be biologically and intellectually efficient by expending the least amount of energy to obtain the result that is as close to the threshold of minimally acceptable as possible. Social loafing also affects accountability. When a team's performance falls below a certain level and omissions in service or mistakes occur, you'll rarely see anyone put up their hand to accept responsibility. Everyone believes everyone else in the team is to blame. There's a great anecdote that's often used in lectures about social loafing to illustrate this point, where a man has a heart attack and drops to the floor dead at a cardiology conference. 500 of the best cardiologists in the world, and no one moves to help him for nearly 10 minutes, despite the fact the man's obviously having an arrest. Everyone thought that everyone else was going to take responsibility for resuscitating the man. And when they were all interviewed by the police after the event, they all claimed that since no one else seemed worried, everything must have been okay, and they didn't worry either. But the Guinea Pig Club was a team too. How did they overcome social loafing and produce such good outcomes?
There is no I in guinea pig.
So what are the elements that make up a good team? Well, we can extract a fair bit from what we know about the Guinea Pig Club, and there are some pretty sensible and sometimes easily implemented ways to overcome social loafing. I'll talk about these key elements in no particular order, but I want to make it clear that I'm under no illusions. When I say sometimes, I know that it will be rare to find an environment where all of the elements I mention here are present or implementable. That's why the Guinea Pig Club was unique. But it's also equally rare to find a ward where at least one of the following elements aren't present or couldn't be implemented with a little effort.
Relationships.
Pervasive and fairly intense relationships are critical for developing effective teams. That is, they need to work together, train together, and play together. This means they become friends rather than colleagues, and no one wants to let their friends down. Additionally, closer relationships between staff and patients should be positively encouraged. If patients become friends with staff and vice versa, there is a sense that everyone is working towards the same goal and everyone becomes mutually supportive.
Value.
It's important that a team knows its value Without value, there's no worth, and no one wants to think their contribution is worthless. If any member of a team thinks that their contribution is without value, then they're bound to reduce their effort accordingly, and certainly they won't be going the extra mile for anyone. So it's important that positive feedback is given by management, colleagues, and even patients.
Flattened hierarchies.
When I say flattened hierarchies, I mean that essentially the martial structure of communications that still prevails in hospital wards today is dispensed with, and everyone is spoken to as an equally valued member of a team, where all staff are included in the decision-making process and they're able to contribute their thoughts. Rather than being directed or instructed, then people start to feel as if they are valued. And if that is the case, they have an investment in the outcome of a decision, and so are much, much more likely to make efforts to facilitate a positive outcome.
Careful task assignation.
If a team has a described set of tasks to do, it's worthwhile giving careful thought about how those tasks are allocated. It's a disaster to make a general statement like, "Obs and pills need to be done at 8 a.m. and even worse, to state nothing at all. Rather, individual members of a team must be given responsibility for critical tasks and acknowledged when those tasks are completed.
Scrutiny.
The knowledge that your work is being scrutinised is a powerful cure for social loafing. Whether that scrutiny comes from your peers or from your patients doesn't matter. It doesn't matter either whether it's formal or informal. Scrutiny is not an issue for anyone that pulls their weight, but for social loafers, it presents a bit of an obstacle to their sleeping. This, tied up with the flattened workplace hierarchy and the development of good relationships, is the triad that largely resulted in the Guinea Pigs Club's success.
Clear understanding of objectives.
Objectives need to be understood, written down, and broadcast to both staff and patients. It's a critical move to overcome confusion and ambiguity of purpose.
Choice.
I mentioned earlier that care needs to be taken with assigning critical tasks. One way of doing this more effectively is giving equally qualified team members a choice about what tasks they do. This increases their investment in the outcome and engenders a sense of personal obligation and responsibility to get the task done as best they can. Teams that are faced with limited resources, who know they are faced with limited resources, and this has been acknowledged by their managers, tend to perform better if outcomes are framed as challenges. This acknowledges the skills of team members, that their situation is difficult, and that their contribution is essential to success. Psychologists have found that clearly stated, obviously difficult challenges are far more often overcome by teams with limited resources than when ambiguous, mundane challenges are set.
Reward and recognition.
There's been a lot of research conducted in this area, but there's pretty solid research now to show that rewarding higher performing individuals within a group virtually always results in no improvement to the group's overall productivity, and in nearly all cases, results in a deterioration in the intra-group dynamics. The same body of research also shows that there is no difference in outcomes if the team is recognised and rewarded as a whole, or if the team is rewarded and then equivalent value rewards are given to individual members of the team. Yet, with the latter, there is the inherent risk of resentment or feelings of isolation developing amongst team members that are not selected for individual reward. So the take-home message is that you shouldn't single out individuals in a team for their efforts. It's a recipe for disaster.
The two pizza rule.
Although you rarely see big teams on a hospital ward, it's worthwhile noting that the bigger the team, the greater the opportunity for social loafing. It's much harder to slack off in a team of four than a team of 10. Amazon has done an astonishing amount of research into social loafing and building effective teams, and they now use the two pizza rule. If you can't feed a team with two pizzas, then the team is too big to be productive.
Clear performance standards.
Curiously, one of the commonest things I have heard from new staff in my career is the statement, "I have no idea what I'm supposed to be doing." The lack of clear performance standards is an invitation to social loafing, and it's understandable. If a staff member doesn't know what's expected of them and no one tells them, eventually they'll give up trying to guess and reduce their output accordingly.
Peer evaluation.
Traditionally, individual evaluations of performance are conducted by managers who rarely actually see their staff in practice. However, when that evaluation is handed over to peers who see their colleagues perform every day, any cases of social loafing immediately stand out. Introduce peer rather than managerial performance evaluation, and no one will want to be identified by their colleagues as slacking off. So social loafers come into line and outputs start to improve.
Communication.
Encouraging free flow of communication amongst members of a team has been repeatedly shown to improve team performance. That's because everyone knows what everyone else is up to and duplication of tasks is avoided. Plus, social loafers will identify when they are duplicating a task and likely avoid it, relying on the other team member to actually complete the task rather than themselves.
Skill mix.
This is a tricky one for your everyday ward environment, but better team outcomes are always obtained when there is a greater diversity of skills within a team, especially if each team member has specific critical skills other members don't have. And that's both because it's very difficult for an individual team member to mask underperformance when they are the only person able to do a specific task, and also because once the objectives of the day are completed, it's a great feeling to know you were an essential and indispensable link in the process to facilitate this. So if you can incorporate at least one of these elements into your team practices or workplace, then you are well on your way to forming your very own guinea pig club. Remember, good teams are the key to good clinical outcomes, not an abundance of human or material resources. I can guarantee that no matter what resources you have on your ward right now, you have enough to potentially do just as well as the Burns Ward of the Queen Victoria Hospital in 1940s wartime England. Have you ever worked as a team member on a ward that has produced consistently good outcomes? Well, why was that? I'm interested in your story. We're interested in your story. Feel free to tell us on the AusMed website comments section for this podcast. What elements made your team so effective? This is the AusMed Handover Podcast, and my name is Darren Wake. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, then I invite you to subscribe for future episodes. And I also invite you to leave comments and reviews and tell your friends about us too. And if you have a topic you think would make for an interesting episode, please let us know. Thank you for listening. Nibbles? Yes, I know I said I was going to interview you. I was just kidding. I'm sorry. No, it's not actually about guinea pigs. Can you put the knife down? Can somebody please call security?